Today's program was brought to you by Le Creuset, made in France since 1925. The first and finest enameled cast iron cookware, a favorite for generations. For more information, visit lecreuset.com. That's LECREUSET.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. The topic? Restaurants and rules. Some rules are based on religion.
This makes for an unusual scene in a Manhattan restaurant. A shy 20-year-old dictating the kitchen standards to a humble veteran chef.
While other rules promote health and safety.
But who are these feared rule keepers with the power to shut a restaurant down?
They're not really like food lovers.
Some restaurant rules fall outside the domain of the kitchen.
All civil rights issues have basically, at one point or another, revolved around the bathroom.
For more, tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guests are Michelle and Suzanne Rousseau, Jamaican-born sisters, chefs, and authors. They established their culinary reputation with the debut of Chow Bella in 1996, a groundbreaking restaurant in Kingston that created a paradigm shift with its artful use of Jamaican ingredients and classic cooking techniques. The success of that restaurant led to the women being called on to create premium culinary events, including several state dinners and an official dinner for His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales. Their expertise has since evolved into creating food and beverage concepts for global clients. At home, Michelle and Suzanne use their culinary knowledge and effervescent personalities to inspire appreciation for Jamaican traditions with their hugely popular food and travel show, Two Sisters and a Meal. They also produced and starred in the web series Island Potluck, a joint production with the Jamaica Tourism Board. Their first cookbook, Caribbean Potluck, received critical acclaim and was named among NPR's best books of 2014. And this year, they have released Provisions, I don't know if I call it a follow-up to that cookbook, but it is a new cookbook that they've released, and it is absolutely gorgeous. Suzanne and Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
Yes.
Thank you
feel
for
like
having us.
This has been in the works for a minute now.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
True.
And we've had calls between New Jersey and Jamaica talking about planning this. So I'm so happy to have you both here.
We're really honored.
And we're very happy to be here.
So Provisions, I alluded to it in the intro, but I'm going to let both of you explain Provisions.
Who do you want to talk first? Okay, so this is Suzanne speaking. I think Provisions for us was obviously our second effort at a cookbook. I think we, in the first cookbook, Caribbean Potluck, we began the exploration of our family line, particularly of our matriarchal female line, and discovered really, really interesting information about our great-grandmother, Martha Matilda Briggs, that really, I think, sensitized us to the stories of some of the women in our family that we had not been aware of and didn't know of and maybe had never taken the time to really pay any note to. And I think for us, there was a twofold intention here. One was to explore the ingredients of the region. We say it's a very ingredient-focused book. And the other was to dig into that narrative some more about her and the impact that she would have had on the world with her culinary career, really, and how that sort of connected us to our own culinary career and our own life. And I'll let my sister Mish continue on from there.
And I think, I mean, after you mentioned Caribbean Potluck, and I think Caribbean Potluck, when we were doing our promotions, we found there was such a great level of interest by people from, you know, everywhere, from in the UK, from here in Canada, about the ingredients themselves. And so even though that was not an ingredient-focused book, anytime we did appearances, they wanted to know what's ackee exactly and what. And so we felt that it was important to tell a story that's centered around the ingredients, but we're both huge history buffs and we love to research and we love, you know, linking the past to the present. Not as a way of going back to the past and glorifying it or glamorizing it, but more to inform your consciousness for how you evolve in, you know, if into the future, but retain a connection and a sense of authenticity with your heritage and your culture. And so in that kind of process, I would say, you know, telling the stories of the women was important, telling the stories of the ingredients was important, but then kind of trying to connect the two. And I think that was really the work in the book, is to find how we could take these modern recipes that were ingredient driven and connect them back to us and our family and these women and, you know, history of slavery and all of that kind of stuff. And so that's really to me the essence of what it's about.
Yeah, this cookbook, it feels kind of not wrong, but like not the full picture to call it just a cookbook, because it has so much history, like what you were saying, Michelle. And I want to read one of my favorite parts.
Sure.
That kind of really gets to the root of what Provisions is all about. Women had to use their ingenuity to feed themselves, their families, and their masters. And the culinary techniques and eating habits they developed form the root of what we know as the West Indian diet of today. Mm-hmm. This book is really a tribute to the women that, you know, did so much of the work, fed everyone, mm-hmm. and got no thanks or credit for it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, their traditions that they established in just through pure ingenuity are what we see in West Indian cooking today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. I think, you know, one of the things that sort of came home to us as we started looking at the work, and we started looking at it first as the ingredients and then the commonality of these ingredients throughout all of the islands that we had sort of traveled in the Caribbean. And then we started looking at sort of the history of slavery and, you know, colonization and the impact that had on how the food evolved. I think the compelling story that then connected to our own personal narrative was of the cooks and the nurturers have always been the women. We come from this, you know, wonderful matriarchal culture, and yet we had never really stopped to examine the cuisine from that perspective or that lens before. And here we were as women in the industry, in this world, doing the same thing somehow at a much obviously higher level than it was done before. And it was a kind of very beautiful and sort of patent and very compelling story that was obviously very personal at the same time, when we looked at the story about this woman who was our great grandmother, that really we felt needed to be told. And I think, you know, when we thought of all of the most memorable moments of our lives and all of the most delicious moments of our lives, they were oftentimes in the company of family members, aunts, uncles, nannies, housekeepers, people we'd met on the roadside cooking, you know, saltfish and yam, or that delicious pone that we picked up on the road when we were fat 10 driving to the country. And so it was, you know, all of these wonderful women and different of every walk of life, really, of every kind of, from every level of society, who had made an impact on us through the flavors and the meals that they had shared with us. And so I think that sort of helped to connect all of the pieces of the story together. Mm-hmm. And it was very, I think, for us, an emotional journey, you know, and a very personal one in many ways.
Mm-hmm. And that spirit of generosity is something that shines through, you know, the women of the region in multiple ways. And I think that it's not recognized often enough. Like many other countries, Jamaica's not alone in this. You know, even though women are largely the cooks, they retain their positions in a more domesticated, calm role or space. And when you look at the actual restaurants and the hotels and the executive chefs and the really higher paid levels and more developed levels of this career, this field that we are in, you know, very few of them are held by women. And yet at the same time, the women and the female entrepreneurs, and that their entrepreneurship really came through food and preparing food, the things that they had at their fingertips, the things that they could use, the skill set that they actually had already honed, is really how they built businesses that have sustained and supported the family equally as much as the men. And so, you know, in slavery, and especially post-emancipation, the women were the ones who went to market to sell, you know, and I think that there's never been enough acknowledgement of that and the impact that that would have had on the evolving and developing cuisine. And whether that is a society like Jamaica or whether that's a society like Trinidad, where you then had, you know, a large Indian migration and you know, Indian mothers were then influencing the food in a different way. You know, I think that's how the cuisine evolves and changes in a continuous way. And I think that was something that we wanted to examine much deeper.
And I think to the point of the markets, at least certainly for our personal sort of narrative in the Jamaican context, I mean, the markets were the places where they could get dressed in their lit finery, that they could be sort of free to sort of socialize and carouse, but they could then, you know, sell their wares, but they could meet with friends and gather. So it had so many, you know, both, you know, so many different sort of connotations, emotional and social ones, and the culture there that would have evolved from that. Opportunities to meet with, you know, slaves at other plantations, or to trade and sell their wares, to become known for their cooking or their skill in making one particular thing, as well as the history. So it just began to just kind of,
and
no,
it was probably expand. Also it was also probably a space where they spread news of rebellion.
Yeah.
You know, where rebellion sort of, you know, had a, where they could communicate freely, because otherwise they would never really have had much spaces like that.
Right.
So it was important for us to tell this story
in this way. And at this time of year, too, in Jamaica, we have something called Grand Market, which is like the big sort of, it would have been, I guess, the day they were allowed to, in the old plantation times, would have been a day where everybody was allowed to celebrate and be free, which were usually on Christmas Eve. And we still call it Grand Market, and people still go out on the road and still celebrate. But it's obviously a very different reality. So it was, you know, this was the time of year that festivity was really allowed and a day off was given, but also they were the opportunity to gather and commune. And so, you know, there were so many, there was so much to celebrate in that story, and there was much as there was loss and brutality and hurt and pain, there was so much beauty in that as well, which is, I think, is what we wanted to bring forward in this book.
So one of those stories, and Michelle, I know you're the history buff.
Yes. Absolutely.
Which you dug deep into your family history for this book. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about your great-grandmother a little more? I know you mentioned her briefly, but I think her story is so fascinating. So can you
tell us about her? So her name is Martha Matilda Briggs, and she is my father's grandmother, so my father's maternal grandmother. And she, you know, we were growing up, we always heard vague references to her, I would say, nothing in great detail, that she was a woman who was strident and powerful and formidable, and she was one of the best bakers and the greatest patty makers in Jamaica. And yet, you know, today there's no patty business. So I think what started for us as research into, you know, what happened to the patty recipe evolved into an awareness that she wasn't just a patty maker. She actually owned a restaurant in the late 1920s called the Royal Cafe. And then from that, which she purchased, it was on Barry Street. It was across from the offices of Myers and Fletcher, which was the number one law firm at the time. And all of the barristers and attorneys of the day used to dine at her establishment with regularity, including Norman Washington Manley. And there was, you know, as I discovered that source, then I was able to search a bit more into, like, you know, tracing her story. And I think what we recognized, and Suzanne can jump in here, but what we recognized about her is that she really was one of these women who stood her ground, didn't give in to the norms of the day, which was that black women, let alone black women, did not own businesses or property. My father's brother tells us that she owned three houses on Retirement Road, that she lived in one and she ran her restaurant in the basement of the other. And just by looking through that and listening to people speak about her, we realized that, you know, I found, you know, 14 or 15 snippets about her in the Gleaner archives. Not only did she sue somebody for running over her foot and so not allowing her to make patties, she sued them for £100, which in the back then would have been a lot of money. And, you know, but in that story is where I found how much she used to sell the patties for. You know, like, I lost my income for X months at selling X patties a day, which I stood on my feet to make. And so, you know, the articles and the stories about her really displayed her character, and I don't think anybody else could have revealed that to us in such an expressive way, because for whatever reason, the stories in the family never centered around her. It was always around the men in the line. And then the other big story was that she was defended by Norman Manley in a court case where they had revoked her tavern license. So, you know, I think that part of that, of the discovering who she was, really it kind of opened our eyes to the fact that she couldn't have been the only woman like this. You know, as much as it was abnormal that this was her story, it was probably a pretty common story, except hers just happened to be documented. And I think that was an impetus for us to dig and delve a little deeper into other women like that and talk to other women who, you know, we could get these kinds of stories from.
Yeah, I think about this often, but, you know, reading your book, it really reminded me kind of why I do the work that I do. Mm-hmm. It's because those stories should be documented. And, you know, not just in the sense of, you know, a court case or a product, but, you know, who are these women? Because I think there's plenty of women doing exceptional work today. And
absolutely,
we'll lose those stories when we lose them.
Absolutely.
They're not shared as much as male stories.
And I think
are.
One of the things that we found, or that, you know, was fascinating, was once we took sort of this view of the work, or this sort of angle with the work, really looking at it from the female perspective and our own personal, really what was fascinating was that everybody you spoke to about food or cooking, particularly, you know, people that we knew well or we had interacted with in the islands, had stories of their grandmothers, their aunts, their memories of things that were cooked, things that had evolved over time and changed. You know, I remember I called one lady who is a family friend, my Aunt Shirley, whose recipe is the guava jam. And when I said to her, so what would be different today in how you cooked when, you know, you were a child? And she said, well, you know, during the war, which I didn't even think about this, there were rations. So when, you know, we still at Christmas time make Christmas pudding, which is obviously a very British tradition that we've inherited and kept. And she says, my mother used to take figs, which in Jamaica are little small bananas. And because we couldn't get the dried fruit, and because sugar was hard to come by because it was wartime and there were rations on the ships, they would dry figs out in the sun to make a kind of dried fruit that could be soaked in wine and rum for the month to make a Christmas pudding. So that out of this inventiveness and invention and this sort of taking ingredients and manipulating them to work in other ways would be the Christmas pudding. And then the fascinating thing was that she told me this, and she would be my father's contemporary. My father's 80, actually, coming up next week. And she's known my dad since she was a child. So this would have been her mother. I then was talking to another sort of elder, another woman who is probably Mrs. Trench's mom, Mrs. Donaldson, who we have two recipes from there, the mango chutney and the marmalade. And she was sort of very not well that day and sort of poorly. So I was recording her. And when I started to ask her about her mother and her grandmother, what was so fascinating was that they did the same thing. Yet I had never ever talked sort of what were the traditions and sort of how did you learn this mango chutney or how did you learn to make this marmalade. So like her marmalade recipe was like a third generation. So her daughter was a fourth generation of women. So she learned that recipe from her mother, who her grandmother was this baker. So I found I did a lot of that part. And they don't they actually put the pulp on the rind because that helps create the pectin, and it's a pectinless marmalade. Wow. But what was fascinating was to just, you know, speak to all of these women who maybe no one had ever stopped to sort of talk to about these things before, tell you all of these memories of what they ate, how they consumed them, and what were the traditions and habits that were then alive, what has been lost, what has been retained, because for the most part they're very much oral, and as a result you tend to lose them.
And if you don't speak to people and get the stories, then the stories disappear, you know, and I think that was what we felt a sort of a sadness about, that, you know, we never took the time to speak to our grandmother, who would have been able to tell us all about her mother.
Yes.
You know, and really get, you know, forget the recipe, you know, it's not about the recipe. It's really more about, you know, this story of how they lived, how they survived. And that was common across. I was in St. Kitts working on a project, and I was interviewing a young gentleman who was telling me about his mother. And his story was that they're over in St. Kitts during the war. You know, ships weren't crossing, and they started to use more, things like breadfruit flour and cooking with cassava flour because they couldn't get imported ingredients anymore, which were common before, you know. So I think that's a narrative. And then there's that great story Mrs. Donaldson told you about the gifts at Christmas.
Yeah.
Which is
so
also
she would. And so she, this Mrs. Donaldson or Gwen, she was a big entertainer. So she would cook and like have these 100-person, you know, cocktail and dinner parties,
wow,
but do all of her own cooking. And they would make this candy that is a, it's like a citron,
candied
they call
peel.
It. It's like a candied peel where they would candy like this peel of like,
wow,
I guess, citrus fruit, which apparently it was very, very British thing to do. And I think it's still sold in sort of, you know, well-known stores and emporiums in the UK, that they would gift when people came or, you know, when they were going to other people's homes. And then I was like, but I've never even tasted that. So it was also an interesting exploration in how food has evolved, mm-hmm, and how, you know, the habits that how habits change and how things that were once in style come out of style
and
or
come back into style
or come back into style and traditions are lost. And, you know, that was really, I think, the joyful sort of pleasurable part of this exploration. And in fact, one of the women, Mama Sita, who is a friend's grandmother, who we have the arepa recipe inspired by, who we met during high school, and every time she would come from Venezuela, they would have this huge arepas feast, and we would be like, they'd say, "Come over,
Mama Sita
is here," and we would. Usually, it was Christmas time and or January, and we'd go and eat to our heart's content. Actually, she passed away a few months ago, so in some way, I think for us, it's that, you know, it felt important to tell the stories while they were still here, to have them, even if it's, you know, it's a cookbook, it's the best we could do, but it was still important. So I think for them, in particular, the war wars and that family, who Mama Sita's family, they were, I think, very, they didn't know we had taken the recipe and done it, so they were very happy when they saw it.
Wow, that's so beautiful, and like, yeah, just speaks to like the why retaining
intention.
These stories is, mm-hmm, so important.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The recipes in here are so contemporary.
Mm-hmm,
And I'm going to read another little part that I found like so fascinating when I was reading this. Despite our pleasure at discovering the unknown recipes of our heritage, we did not wish to focus on recreating dishes of the past. We love the traditional recipes of our grandparents, but there needs to be a new presentation of our food that is both accessible to all and relevant to modern life. This cookbook draws on inspiration from our culinary heritage, but offers a new spin on the typical ingredients so often featured in old-time West Indian cooking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How did you come to that sort of decision?
I think that was very deliberate. I think in many ways, you know, Suzanne and I have a very particular style of eating, and we've lived and traveled around a lot, and we've lived in many different places, and I've lived in Europe, and I've lived in New York, and we've lived in Canada, and we were in Trinidad, we were in Jamaica, and so how we eat and how we like to eat is very much health focused, ingredient focused, and very similar to how the recipes in the book are. And so what I really felt when I was kind of, you know, trying to really structure the book, you know, in terms of just how the chapter flow would be. We knew what the recipes would be straight off the bat. We knew the kind of recipes we wanted. And that was because, one, we couldn't find books that had these kinds of recipes. Two, we wanted to present the ingredients in different ways that were not being utilized to the maximum range of capacity of the ingredients themselves. So, you know, because in Jamaica we boil green banana, everybody just eats boiled green banana. But when we went to Dominica, they had curried green banana. And when we were here, they eat it this way. And when we were there, you know,
pickled.
So we just started to say, you know, we have to bring it together, but with our sort of flavor profile and how we like to eat and the type of food we like to serve in our businesses and restaurants, and present it that way. And I think, you know, more and more what you see happening throughout the Caribbean and throughout the West Indies, and I'm sure it's the same in any country like Latin America or Africa or India, you have generations of children leaving their homes to come and study in other parts of the world, whether that is Europe or whether that's America or whether that's Canada. And then they either stay or they return home. But when you return home, your consciousness about your food has evolved, because you can't eat grandma's stew at university in the dorm. You know, that's not available. That's something you would go home on the weekends to get. And so the way the culture of the world has evolved is that, you know, people are dining out. Food needs to be more accessible. It needs to be quicker. There's a lot more one pot cooking, single meals. Healthier. You know, I live alone, healthier. So I need to be able to come home and bam, bam, bam. And I have dinner on the table. I'm not cooking for kids or family or husbands. And so we really wanted food that would be relevant. When we say relevant, that's what we mean. Relevant to second and third generation West Indian people who, even if they do live at home, don't want to eat the way that, you know, mom and dad and mm-hmm. grandma and grandpa ate, which was very different, you know, a lot more hearty stews and larger portions of starch. And, you know, this, you know, nowadays people want more vegetables, more protein, cleaner foods, healthy fats, you know, gluten-free, you know, all of those things are not only are they trending, but it was actually what the traditional diet was. Very, very close to that, you know, right. So simple flame roasted starches, flame roasted proteins, unsalted and cured proteins. So you see speck on menus and prosciutto and, you know, that's a salted and cured protein, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? And so you're seeing all, you know, the pickled herring, you know, traditional pickled herring in Jamaica, which, you know, it's not in the book because the book is vegetarian, but those types of dishes are very much, you know, trending again and they never went out of style in Jamaica. So right. How do you prepare it in a way that someone of today will eat it?
Also think it was, how do we make the food that has not been received outside of the region accessible to everybody and mm-hmm. not make it just Caribbean food? Mm-hmm. So sure. I think it was a twofold. I think we were twofold in the intention. One was sort of from our own food consciousness of having a more sophisticated approach to food, having traveled and eaten widely. How do we take and look at the ingredients in the region as we would prepare it and how would we want to eat it? And how do we present the food in a way that the modern sort of, you know, gourmet or epicurean or foodie, for lack of a better word, can also have access to the cuisine of our region without feeling that it is something that is foreign or too out there or too hard to prepare. Because that's the only way I think that we can translate and take it outside of our region. Because I think that's where for a big part of the challenge of the region's cuisine has been the lack of accessibility and translatability outside of the region itself. And I think that in part was another thing that we wanted to do, to really present it very with fresh eyes, with a modern approach, in the language that every cook who cooks out everywhere part of the world would appreciate and see. Because I think one of the challenges of Caribbean cuisine as a whole is that, certainly Jamaican cuisine, I would say, is that it is still very much presented in the ways it has been for decades and decades and decades.
Right.
And people still eat it that way and are very stuck to their traditions and very loyal. So they are reticent to change, but also reticent to explore. So it was a sort of multiple layered reasons why we felt it needed to have that new sort of language and new face, really, a new presentation, because at the same time we wanted to present the food in refined and beautiful and elegant settings.
Mm. Yeah.
So, go ahead.
No, and it just, and that's why we made an effort to make it clear that it's not traditional, it's modern, so mm-hmm. that people don't say, but this is not Caribbean food, you know, and then dismiss the work without really getting an opportunity to try and see what it really is like.
So a couple things. One, I totally agree about, you know, West Indian food being viewed one way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even as a writer, like when I write about Caribbean chefs, like there is this expectation that, you know, I'm going to talk about jerk and rice mm-hmm. and beans. And like, there's so much more.
Yeah, it's extremely limiting and very narrow.
Right.
Yeah.
And then also, it took me like getting into the book a bit, and I was like, wait a minute, this is all vegetarian. Mm-hmm. I'm even hesitant to say that because I feel like when we say vegetarian cookbooks in America, like there's like this certain
yes.
box.
Exactly. Yes, box there's this like narrow box that comes around it, and this doesn't fit into that box.
I mean, if we were to compare the work, I mean, you know, not we can compare it to his work, but we were that book that Otto Lengi did, Plenty. Mm-hmm. You know, where it was about the vegetables, and it happened to be, it may not have been a vegetarian cookbook because I'm sure there was meat in it, but the book was about the vegetables. That's what this work was for us. It was about the vegetables and the ingredients themselves. Mm. And if it so happened that the book is vegetarian, then okay, fine. But it doesn't mean if you're a non-vegetarian that you shouldn't buy it, because you can certainly add bacon to that salad or, you know, grilled meat on the side of this dish, or, you know what I mean? So mm-hmm. it's really, it either gives you a wholesome range of ingredients for a vegetarian or even a vegan, because there are things that can be changed. And it gives a meat eater a lot of really great sides and salads and you know, cocktail snacks. And, you know, it's very diverse that way. And we try to make it very diverse that way. And so much of the trade historically in the Caribbean was built around the trade of food, sugar and cocoa and coffee and rum. Pineapple and rum and bananas. And, you know, even Christopher Columbus was in search of spices when he landed on the West Indies, you know. So I think so much of our industry and our economy and our heritage and our culture is built around these ingredients, that to do a book focused on history in any way and that does not acknowledge that would be remiss of us. Because I think, they weren't talking about oxtail or goat or you know, jerk then. What they were talking about was these things. Right. And so that was really a big part also of why we felt the need.
Yeah. And I think also it's very much our own style of cooking. Like, yeah, I mean, I think the book is a representation of the way that we eat and the way that we like to eat and the ingredients we eat in the way that we do them.
And how our tables look.
So it would, outside of all the other reasons, it really is our food personality that speaks through in this work. Because this is the way that we like to eat, whether we're eating in Jamaica or any part of the world. And oftentimes in our business and in our years of both catering and restaurants, a lot of these types of dishes will appear as sides and accompaniment to rack of lamb and grilled pork and, you know, chicken with salsa verde and a host of other wonderful meat products. So, I mean, I think a big part of our style of cooking and our style of creating menus has always been to have wonderful accompaniments of multiple different kinds of dishes that are alongside meat or protein dishes. So I think this is very authentic to us as well in terms of just how we go around and how we look at our own ingredients and the ingredients that we have grown up with and how we have, in the course of the years that we have cooked and catered and run restaurants, how we have started to, you know, to treat them and use them and sort of serve them to others. And so it really does really show, you know, very much our personal aesthetic towards the cuisine and towards this food in general.
And the table.
Yeah.
These are all
definite. Yeah, the pictures are absolutely gorgeous. Like, yeah, it feels like you're sitting at someone's table.
Well, this
table.
Is Suzanne. Yeah. Suzanne did a lot of that propping when she scoured aunt's tables and houses to get all of the china and the tablecloths and all of those lovely things. Wow. So,
yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more.
Yay. Thank you.
Hey, I'm Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I was introduced to Le Creuset cast iron skillets many years ago in my first restaurant, Muggsy's Chow Chow in the East Village. Le Creuset has the superior heat retention of cast iron paired with unparalleled performance and the ease of enamel. That means delicious food with easy cleanup. And I love easy cleanup after running my own restaurants in New York for 23 years. Le Creuset original heirloom cookware is backed by a lifetime warranty. Their bold colors and timeless designs allow for an expression of personal style in the kitchen and beyond. Head to lecreuset.com/HRN. That's LECREUSET.com to see all the new products and amazing holiday gift deals. HRN listeners will get 20% off the new Le Creuset cookbook with the code HRN.
All right, so we are back with Suzanne and Michelle Rousseau, sisters, authors, chefs, restaurant owners, globetrotters. I could keep going on. Okay, so now I want to hear about, I know you spent some time in Trinidad growing up too, but what was dining like in Jamaica when you were growing up?
In Jamaica?
Mm-hmm.
Or in Trinidad?
Both.
So who will take one? I think my memories of Jamaica as a child, I mean, we went to Trinidad when I was fairly young, when I was probably 7.5 or 8. So a fairly formative part of my life was spent in Trinidad. So we have very fond favorites and food memories of our time there, and we still go back often. But in Jamaica, growing up, I remember a few things. One thing that is always a sort of standout memory for me is eating patties, tasty patties, on a Saturday or day of the week with my grandmother, who I called Manga, who is Martha Briggs' daughter, out of a brown paper bag, because we always eat patties out of the brown paper bag, and drinking a cola champagne. I remember that as one of the things of my childhood that was like something I loved so much, because I love a patty and I still think it's the best, one of the best things you can have in Jamaica.
Are we talking a regular beef patty?
Yeah, we call them patties. Outside of Jamaica, people call them beef patties, but we just call it a patty. Yeah. And you know, obviously Martha Briggs was famous for her patties, so it seems kind of funny that the memory of her with her daughter is, of course, that, because it's, I see myself, she had a brown Renault, I'd be in the back seat, it was always piping hot and it would almost scald your mouth, but I think of that all the time and think of her. I think of eating bun and getting bun sandwiches at school in my lunch kit, bun and cheese, because, you know, we eat bun, which is like, they do it commercially, but you make bun at Easter time. And my grandmother, that same one, made amazingly delicious buns and Christmas puddings. And my other memory of growing up as a child all around Manga, which is all Ma Briggs' daughter, was making Christmas puddings one Christmas when I maybe would have been 5 or 6. And she had literally like a wash bucket full of the batter. And they were stirring it. It was an all-day affair.
Call it rub the batter.
And they call it rubbing the batter. Because, you know, there was no hand mixer and there was nothing, you know, machine-like. And it was myself, Manga, and Vi, her housekeeper, who was like her, like, her daughter after a time, and another caregiver of ours. And we were there all day. And it was just an all-day hands-on. And I was just thrilled. And I kept licking it. And licking it and eating the spoon and saying, can I taste it? So those are the things I would say as a child of Jamaica. I remember as very formative and such a really heartfelt and just wonderful memories. And they were always around my grandmothers and, you know, aunts with food. And Mish, you talk about Trinidad.
I have one memory, two memories of Jamaica that stand out. And I have Trinidad too, but is that I was a porridge baby. I was obsessed with porridge and I still kind of am. So every morning I remember, and I don't know how I remember this because I must have been about 3 or 4, but I remember getting up, getting myself dressed for school all on my own, going
because
outside.
Because she was always on time, you know, and I was always late. Yeah. Because my sister was always well-behaved.
So mom and dad would be sleeping, everybody would be sleeping, and I would go out, and Inez would have made a pot of cornmeal porridge, and I would settle myself, and she put condensed milk, and I would just, I would eat my breakfast and sit and patiently wait until.
Wow.
And Suzanne cornmeal rose. Porridge has like nutmeg, cinnamon and coconut condensed milk. Oh my God.
So good. And they'll make it sometimes with a cinnamon leaf or bay leaf in there. Oh, it's real country style. Love that. And paradise plums. Growing up, we had this sweet called paradise plums. And it is like a sort of a flat, round sweetie that had a very tart center. It was pink on one side and orange on the other.
Orange.
And it had like a strawberry berry with like a acid, like a tart center with like a orange. Almost, so a three-tone
almost
sweet.
Like how you know, like a powdered vitamin C taste.
Yes.
Uh-huh. On the
but with like hard crusted sugar on the outside.
Wow.
And
okay.
I would suck that until the top of my mouth would be cut. So those are my two, like, I mean, among other things, those are the main ones. Trinidad was a whole nother culinary world. I mean,
it's incredible.
When we got to Trinidad, I think it would be the first part of my life that really opened my palate up, because they have such dynamic food that is a, you know, uses savory, sweet, starchy,
chutneys,
spice all
and
together.
Just so, pickles and it's just
so
fantastic.
Every day on my way home in Trinidad, we would stop and at the corner store, you know, because we talk in Trinidad when we're talking like this. You gotta talk about Trinidad, you gotta talk in the Trini accent, right?
I always try to tell people the accents are different.
Yeah, very different.
So you gotta talk in the Trini accent, yes.
Yeah.
So when we would, on our way home, we would stop off to get
salt
like
prune
snacks.
Dust,
and I would get salt prune dust, which was basically have you ever had a Chinese sweetie
or like a pickled, salted Chinese prune. Chinese sweetie, or they call them wamwai
or whatever. Anyway, so it's like a salted like prune that is dried up.
Oh my God.
And like and has salt and sweet. But in we have those in Jamaica.
We eat those a lot in the Caribbean, by the way.
Jamaica,
Trinidad, very obsessed with Chinese sweeties.
Okay,
that's what we call them.
Yes, and so but in Trinidad they were the big red ones, and they would grind them up and sell the powder that they would wrap up in a little brown paper packet, and I'd be like.
And, like the pomsitae.
And Suzanne would buy pickled pomsitae.
Pickled pomsitae.
Which
so
is like a
June plum in its green state. They peel them and they have them soaking. You
in
them
vinegar
soaking in jars
and pepper.
Of vinegar and pepper.
And you buy it.
And you buy it. And like, we eat them in Jamaica ripe. So it's very different how we eat. So in Trinidad, everything is pickled. I guess there's a lot of that Indian influence. Pickles, chutneys, jams, layers and layers of fantastic
So Suzanne would always buy that, and they would wrap it up in brown paper.
In brown paper, and we would eat it on the way home in the car then, with mommy.
And my last one, which is, well, two other things, but one is that so mango chow is when you have turned mango, and then you actually pickle it with vinegar and pepper and stuff.
And salt.
So we had some mango trees, and in Trinidad, we would always eat mango chow. We were obsessed with mango chow till we get sick. So we would peel it and then pickle it and eat like four mangoes and say, we want more? Let's go get more. So we'd go outside and climb the tree
and
get more
season.
Mangoes in mango season. And then in Trinidad, they eat snow cone with condensed milk on top. So I would go and get my snow cone and I would get condensed
milk. You get
those
milk. When you go around the savannah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the savannah, you could go and get the snow cones and you could get them with condensed milk or without.
Wow.
All of that is very different to how you'd eat in Jamaica, by the way.
Oh, and the tamarind balls.
And the Trinidadian tamarind balls. Oh,
I've
my
had
God.
Those, yeah.
With the salt,
those are really
pepper,
good.
And
those
the sugar.
Are really good.
Yeah. Whereas in Jamaica, we make them with just sugar. So it's like a one-dimensional flavor versus like a three-dimensional flavor.
Yeah. Their food is like all out there. They're like, take me as you see me. You know, there's no holding back.
So what is I've never been to Jamaica. I'm dying to go. What is the dining scene like in Jamaica?
Oh, wow. It's become so active now. When we first started our business many, many moons ago, we were one of like a few restaurants at the time that you really could go to for, you know, whatever, you know, dining for a night out. But it's really had a huge, huge sort of takeoff. Like everything else, I think foodie culture and food awareness has changed. And so you have a host of really wonderful ethnic restaurants, wonderful Japanese, Indian, Chinese, Arabic cuisine. I think we've recently even have a Vietnamese place that's opened up, if you can believe that. And then a lot of, you know, kind of bistro, cafes, coffee shops, wine bars. You know, for the most part, I think Jamaica, we always say the best food in the Caribbean, I think, is consumed in a home or on the street. That's where you have the most authentic, the best, I think, best meals. But I think you have some really good offerings out there. I think you have a challenge, I think, sometimes with consistency of service and consistency of experience. And we know that for ourselves because obviously we've been running restaurants and we're backing it again. But I think it's really taken off. And I think there is a lot of options out there now and a lot of awareness about wine and, you know, fine dining and, you know, dining and drinking and experiencing good experiences for both.
Is there a particular like part of the island that you go to when you're going out to eat?
No, I think each kind of town or parish has their little thing or spot. And, you know, if you go to certain parts of the island, you know you're going more for a rustic experience. There's a really great fish place that is down in Alligator Pond, you know, where he gets fresh catch, but it's really more beachside. So there are individual spots that you can go around. I think to me the most exciting thing that I see happening from a more finer dining perspective in Jamaica is a resurgence of artisans doing gourmet type high level products. So there's one purveyor that we work with who has started to do local charcuterie and it's capicciola and you know really good quality salami and that type of stuff. There's a lady doing local goat's cheese. You know, we have a friend who has just launched an incredible bean to bar chocolate. Is like global scale good. Like the packaging, the branding, everything. You know, you have local arts, ice cream makers, you know, so I think that and a lot of organic farmers doing little things. I think that's very exciting to me because that was not happening 5, 10, 15 years ago.
And I think
all.
You have some really nice local franchises that
yes.
have started or local products that are essentially our own, whether it's, you know, Cafe Blue coffee shops that are the Sharps or even Chilitos in Kingston owned by a friend of ours, Chris. It's a local sort of Jamexican sort of franchise that's sort of incorporating ingredients with that sort of Mexican sort of taqueria sort of. So there are some really indigenous or mestiz in you know, Ocherias doing really uniquely their own Jamaican sort of things, but at a very high level. So, I mean, that I think is very exciting.
I really want to go.
Yeah, you gotta go.
I have to come. I just like the complete diversity of the types of different foods that you have on the island. Like, it sounds like it's become like a melting pot.
For sure.
Of all these different...
And Jamaica is very urban. People don't realize that. You know, a lot of islands are not. But Jamaica and Kingston, it's very much an urban scene. So there is a lot of things to do, you know, and there are a lot of things to do. So it's good to come.
So now I get to ask you a couple of questions that I ask every guest that comes here. Mm-hmm. So let's start with one of your bad food experiences. You can name the restaurant if you want to, but you don't have to. What's one of the worst like restaurant experiences?
Does it have to be a restaurant experience? Or
no.
It could be a food experience.
Food experience.
Okay, I know we're thinking probably of the same
one. Thinking of the same thing. I should let Suzanne tell it, however.
Okay, which one?
I don't know which one you're thinking of.
I mean,
a bad food experience for me would be... Let me think about it. Suzanne, you go first. I have to think about it.
Well, there's two bad... I mean, restaurant experiences, anything with... I mean, it's not food, but when they have bad service or nonchalant bad service, it really infuriates me. I'm a stickler for that. So I would say anytime I get... I don't care how fancy or great the restaurant is, if the service is not up to scratch... then that's a problem. But certainly for me, one of my most unmemorable food experiences was, there are two things I think of. One was when I had to have iguana soup in Curacao.
Oh, we have a different thing.
So disgusting.
It was disgusting.
I was so upsetting to me in every way. The soup was like green.
Oh.
I did not, it was just not, it was terrible. And the other one, which was in Asia,
yes, well, that would be mine then.
Which is the one that I think Michelle is thinking
yes,
of.
Yes, yes.
That really...
is that we had to, when we tasted
durian
for the first time.
That fruit.
Oh, yeah. And some people love it. But
I know it's either revered or hated, but let me tell you something.
It was pretty much hated on our part.
Whoa.
We were like...
There are not many things that I can tell you compared to that first bite. I won't tell you what I said.
Yes, no, it just tastes frozy. That's all.
It's the frosiest thing. And the thing was, we were there not understanding what it was. And it was this massive spiky fruit.
What is it?
And they kept telling us to be careful of the durian. And then when it
smells, right?
Yeah, they say they tie it on the back of the car and pull it home. Because that's how badly the car smells. So
I don't want to eat anything. That
smell when you taste it.
Girl.
Let's just put it that way.
It was rough.
And then it was...
And anytime I buck up liver, I feel pretty traumatized, I have to say. Because I have a liver texture issue.
Organ.
So, yeah, any organ. So if anytime I buck up an organ in my, eating, I'm like... We don't come again. Something isn't right here.
I mean, I can't think of a restaurant experience, but those two are sort of like experiences of
dishes,
eating things that were really...
Not good.
Traumatic, I should say.
Traumatic.
Yes.
Okay, so my last question for you, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
Mm. That's a really good one. I'll start. If it has to, I mean, it could be a restaurant. It could also be like my ideal space would be some sort of villa in the south of France or in a sort of a little village in the south of France where they have outdoor al fresco long tables, and I would love to be there with some of the ancestors. So I would love to sit with someone like a Martha Briggs to hear the story of her life and see how she lived. And I would love to have obviously close family, intimate family like Suzanne and my parents and so on, but some of the great Caribbean intellectuals, a Derek Walcott, a V.S. Naipaul, maybe a Gabriel Garcia Marquez or an artist or, people like that, just to see how, the impact that our culture and the heritage had on them and their art and their work. And also, I always want to ask people what their favorite food is. You know what I mean? I always am like, what's your favorite? I remember reading somewhere that like some president ate, jelly beans or M&Ms or Skittles on his desk. I'm like, really? They eat Skittles? Like, it's just so so humanizing to think that other people eat the same things you do. And I think that's what that would be for me, I think.
What would your meal be?
Like, it would be a sort of a long, opulent, Provençal-style spread with a table filled with, just dishes and fresh ingredients and fresh vegetables and wine and, like just something that we could leisurely sit under an arbor for the whole day eating and talking and that would be, to me, that would be my last supper.
And you said
I don't even have an answer. I would say I would want to be either somewhere in France or somewhere in Italy, because I think you have fantastic food experiences in both of those countries. Maybe a fantastic restaurant in the city. I can't think of a specific one or place. I would want to have amazing wine, copious amounts of champagne, great cheese and as well. And I think I would like all of my family, close family and friends, but also all the people who have passed and left that you can't really get a chance to, both friends and relatives who maybe you never took enough time to listen to or understand or talk to or learn about. And I think it would be really interesting on the same sort of bend that Michelle, I think it would be really interesting to have like the founding fathers of our nation sort of there. Norman Manley, Edna Manley, the Manley family, and sort of Bustamante, all of these, you know, figures of our sort of creation of the sort of national identity. I would love to hear their take on what it was like to grow up and work towards bringing, you know, an awareness of self and, you know, what it was like to sort of lead that charge. I think it must have been a very, they must have been, they're obviously great people, but it would be interesting to talk to them. I mean, I think that sort of era of Jamaica really fascinates me. And I'm sure there's so much more that I could say that would sound more worthwhile, but I would know that I would want some great, like fantastic brick oven pizza done as the Italians do it, as the best way possible. I would want, you know, great salads and pizza, some just wonderful sort of grilled meats, very simple, clean. I mean, it's much more to have a big, diverse table with much more rustic food than it is to have really refined, yes, overly done things. And that's luxury for me, with just fantastic wine, great company and conversation, great music in a city somewhere sort of that I love, or a country that I think is synonymous with great food experiences.
Wow. That's sound like two great parties. sounds like a lot of fun.
It seems to narrow it down to like one place. It's with impossible. One thing. It's too,
you
know, hard.
No. I always tell people, you know, you can invite people you've never met. You can invite celebrities, people who have passed.
And I probably want to have JFK there and like Martin Luther King as well, with Norman and sort of all of these like big thinkers of that sort of time, for sure. I would want all of them there. Nelson Mandela, so kind of knock on everybody's brain a bit.
Yeah. But then it's like, you know, then you die after you get all this great information,
and then you're gone.
Yeah. But no, still, it'd be a great conversation.
Yeah, it would be. But I think it would be to have the people that are there. I think it would be the people that have been meant much to you in their life, and the people that were part of your life that you didn't take the time to know enough to be there as well. So I would say that would be it.
Excellent. Well, I mean, I could talk to you both for like 2 hours more. There's so much in this book, and congratulations to you both. This is a fantastic, exceptional book. And
thank you so much.
I'm really, really happy for you both, and I love it.
Well, we're honored to be here, and thank you for having us on your show. It's been a great time.
New York has been very good to us, and we're very, very, very thrilled to be here with you and to do all of the things that we're doing. It's been really a wonderful
Where can
time.
Listeners follow along, follow your work?
So we have a restaurant in Jamaica called Summer House. So our Instagram handle is summerhouseja. Our website, summerhouseja.com. Our personal brand, we have twosistersandameal.com. And we're around, we're here, you know, we're doing things in the city.
We'll be doing a few more things. We'll be at the Standard, East Village, at Equity at the Table event with Julia Tertian and Clancy Cooks and a whole, Clancy Miller of Clancy Cooks and a whole lot of other wonderful female authors on Tuesday the 11th. I think it is open to the public, but I think you just need to make reservations.
We are coming back in February to do
two talks,
a program at MOFAD, Museum of Food and Drink in Williamsburg,
February 21st. And Julia Tertian is going to moderate that talk with us. And on February the 20th, we'll be at the 92nd Street Y, also doing another talk. We're not quite sure who is moderating that one for us yet.
Excellent. So we'll be around.
We will.
And, you know, people can come to Jamaica.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if they come to Jamaica, come to Summer House and check it out. We have we have items from both of the books on the menu, and we have a great bar. We do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We do Veuve Clicquot Champagne Gardens every couple of months. And so we have
an unplugged live music series with young musicians who are doing their own kind of music in Jamaica. So it's good.
And
it's
a lot
of good
Island stuff. Potluck people can watch on YouTube.
Yes, that's Island Potluck.
I can't recommend it highly enough. It's so much fun.
Yeah, and that was actually great fun too. We did it a little while ago now, but it does show you sort of our perspective and our view of the best places to explore the different sort of scapes of Jamaica, the different places to experience, different kinds of experiences you can have, both culinary and otherwise.
For sure.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much.
Thank you. Oh, it's been
great to be here.
And thank you for listening. We'll catch you next week on The Hungry Society.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.